You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 21st, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the day after the primaries, or the last big day of primaries, I guess I should say. Wither the Tea Party? Question mark. Dave Weigel weighs in. Also on the program today, Florida congressman has a new idea, actually an old idea, for a very old idea, for dealing with uninformed voters. Speaking of uninformed voters, Pat Sajak. Also, NSA reform watered down to the point where supporters no longer support it. Chris Christie finds his state government a mess, decides to renege on a 2011 deal and cut pension funding. Also, the CIA announces that it has stopped its fake vaccination program, which has, by all accounts, contributed to a rise in polio in Pakistan. Meanwhile, Tom Wheeler on the hot seat yesterday in an FCC hearing claims there will not be a fast lane. Well, then what is he talking about? Sherrod Brown has an idea that I suggested weeks ago. Run on expanding Social Security as Republicans set to try and scandalize Social Security disability insurance. Also, David Barron, author of the memos which say it's okay for the United States to strike American citizens with a drone, headed to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that sniffling sound you hear is coming from, oh my God, have I already forgot his name in Pennsylvania?
Oh, Rick Santorum?
Yes, Rick Santorum. As the moral degradation or deprivation or God knows what's going to happen in Pennsylvania now. But Pennsylvania, the latest state to overturn a ban on marriage equality, all the states in the Northeast now allow for proper human rights for people who are not heterosexual.
I think we always got a Tony Soprano it for Santorum. Call him Senator Sanatorium.
Sanatorium.
That was an amazing moment.
And also, FBI has a bit of a problem when it comes to hiring people for their cyber wars. Apparently, people who like to work with computers also like to smoke pot. We will get into all of that and more after we talk to Dave Weigel, which will happen after this short break. I want to tell you folks, if you're new to the program, we are 99% funded by our members. And as a bonus, if you sign up as a member of the Majority Report, not only do you get our daily content, you get an extra 50 minutes a day. So join up today at majority.fm. You can also pick up our app, which is completely free, whether you're a member or not, at majorityapp.com. Listen to the show live. If you're a freebie, listen to the last 25 episodes. If you're a member, listen to the last 800 episodes on the app. And it's a one-touch button to IM me for the funner half of the program. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Dave Weigel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. I want to welcome back to the program from Slate.com, Dave Weigel. Dave, what is your official title there?
I am a political reporter. I think sometimes senior is added to that. Sometimes it isn't, depending on whether I need to be taken seriously.
Well, then the senior, executive senior reporter, political reporter
Esquire.
From Slate, Esquire, yeah. Dave Weigel. Dave, last night was the last big night of primaries. I think there's a couple more, this is going to give us the best sense of what may or may not happen, I guess, come November. By all accounts, it is very unlikely that there'll be any change in the House, but for perhaps a few more Republicans. The real issue is what's going to happen in the Senate. Give us a sense of what happened. Let's run down the list here. There's about a half dozen, nine Senate seats, which will tell us who will control the Senate come November. But Georgia, let's start there. Georgia may be, and I don't know that people considered this in play a year ago or 6 months ago, but Georgia is certainly a big question mark in terms of the fall. What happened on the Republican side in Georgia last night?
Well, so David Perdue, who is a wealthy cousin of the former governor, Sonny Perdue, made his money at Reebok and Dollar General. You know, pretty affable Romney-esque businessman with actual charm. Got in, spend enough to win the first round of the primary. Oh, I should have said at the outset, Georgia has runoff unless somebody gets 50%. The battle was to get in the runoff with him, and the hope among Democrats was that one of three right-wing candidates might get enough to get in there. And it just didn't happen, partly because they cannibalized each other. Phil Gingrey and Paul Brown were kind of infamously right-wing and foot-lodged-in-mouth style politicians. Spent some money and won their districts, but didn't win anything else. And they helped spoil things for Karen Handel, who was the Sarah Palin-endorsed candidate. And it was actually very talented, and I think would have been decent as statewide. Instead, it's Jack Kingston, who was backed by the Chamber of Commerce, got in there. So you have a really boring primary. Nobody pretends it's not boring. Primary runoff between the Chamber of Commerce guy and a wealthy businessman, both of whom are sort of the kind of candidates who always win in Georgia now. And they will be facing Michelle Nunn, who's a very bland centrist Democrat, trying not to say anything offensive, whose best hope, everyone admits, was if a crazy person got in the primary. That's basically what happened there. There were a couple primaries for House seats that didn't change anything, except it's possible that Bob Barr will return to Congress, which would be fun, because he got into the runoff for the old Gingrey seat. The gist, though, is that Democrats wanted a cluster in Georgia and didn't quite get it.
We'll talk a little bit about this in general, but there's been an ongoing narrative about the Republican establishment and the is this the death of the Tea Party? But let's sort of tease this out a little bit here, because really it seems to me, and I'd like your take on this, because you seem to constantly crisscross the country and have spent as much time as anybody, I think, on the ground, getting a sense of the Tea Party and the Republican Party. And I'd be surprised if you ever make it home as far as I can tell. But I mean, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it's gotten to the point now where when we talk about the Tea Party versus the Republican establishment, what we're talking about is really just a function of how much media training has been absorbed. I mean, like the capacity for a candidate not to say something that is patently offensive.
I like the way you put that, because Todd Akin, who was not actually a Tea Party candidate, he was kind of infamously one of these guys I referred to as a tea washer, who is a normal right-wing earmarking Republican who joined the Tea Party caucus in the House, which meant nothing. He's always described as a Tea Party candidate because he lost. That's not what he was. He took advantage of a split in the Tea Party and made a lot of mistakes. But it's illustrated because that is how the quote-unquote establishment, Chamber of Commerce, that's how they view the right. Not as a force that they can change, but as a force they need to prevent from blowing things for them. And I mean, I was putting up a piece just now making a couple points, one of them being the Chamber is not actually forcing the party to its positions on anything. It's just look, Kingston is a good example in Georgia. McConnell's an okay example in Kentucky. Mike Simpson in Idaho, who won a primary won a re-election to Congress, basically, because he beat the Club for Growth candidate. The Chamber endorsed all those guys and spent lots of money. And actually, in Idaho, really lobbied, and their businesses that were allied with them there to turn their voters out for Simpson. The Chamber's big priority for this year, let's remember, was immigration reform. And all these candidates are against immigration reform. All of them are against the Senate's version of it. Kingston on his website, his official congressional website, not just his campaign site, has, you know, slideshows of him meeting with grassroots activists protesting the amnesty bill and him posing with guys dressed as George Washington, what have you. So the Tea Party, even when it goes down, can force these guys to the right. And the Chamber of Commerce can't change their policies at all. All it can do is make sure that the guy who wins the primary doesn't, you know, he votes against their immigration bill but doesn't insult Mexicans on the way. That's about the extent of their power. So there's a lot of kind of predictable quarterbacking today about how great they did. Well, yeah, they won stuff, but compare that to what the Tea Party changed in the Republican Party from 2008 to now. 2008, you could be a Republican if you voted for TARP and if you voted for the auto bailout, if you voted for immigration reform. All that stuff was acceptable. It's totally unacceptable now. None of these guys who won are for any of that stuff. And if you look at some of these pro-business ads, that's how they elect the guys. That's how they nominate them, is saying, don't worry, he's just as right-wing as everyone else, but he's pro-business.
Yeah, and Jack Kingston, it seems to me, I mean, I guess his voting record is rated from a Tea Party perspective, is rated just as well, if not slightly better, than a guy like Gingrich, right? I mean, but he's not prone to, I guess, having to call up Rush Limbaugh and apologize for speaking out of turn or whatever it is. I've been just incredibly frustrated when this sort of label of Tea Party now means just about anything but policy. It just means on some level, like, there's someone who's not going to go out and talk about legitimate rape as opposed to illegitimate rape or say something that is just sort of patently offensive. And I think it's been, frankly, a masterstroke, at least in terms of the way that it impacts the broader narrative. One can debate on the value of the broader narrative. But from a policy standpoint, they're all, you know, Nixon famously said we're all Keynesians. That didn't turn out to be quite the case. But they're all Tea Partiers insofar as their policy positions.
Yeah, I'm a nerd, and I was comparing the Tea Party back in 2009 and 10 to the old William Jennings Bryan populists who then took over the Democratic Party. It's the same thing. I mean, they actually ended up making Democrats unelectable for 20 years, which the Tea Party didn't do, but they turned the Republican Party in its direction with a lot of help, and we can spend ages talking about the reasons this happened. I mean, you had a lot of the intellectual infrastructure for what the Tea Party believes, meeting these activists, meeting who they're trying to nominate, what they're demanding their candidates. You have that put in place by 40 years of spending from wealthy businessmen seeding the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and all AEI and less reputable think tanks, right? You have right now something that I find fascinating because I enjoy watching an issue become populist out of nowhere because a lot of rich people made it populist. You're having fewer and fewer Republicans be willing to extend the export-import thing, which was totally uncontroversial for basically ever. Mm-hmm. There's a New Deal program giving basically money so that American corporations get an edge internationally the way that, you know, frankly, Chinese do a lot of that. And it's been rebranded by first some of the more libertarian Tea Party groups as a bailout for business. Americans' prosperity was whacking against it. Now you find these candidates who are winning these primaries with the support of the mainstream Chamber of Commerce Republicans. You know, they're against the Export-Import Bank, too. So you really kind of, even if the Tea Party candidate does not win the race, you need to pay attention to what is fulminating at Tea Party rallies in order to see what they're going to stand for. I mean, honestly, as I looked at the results, there's a big difference in 2010 when the establishment literally lived in fear of one of its candidates getting knocked off in a primary. It didn't happen as much as as it could have happened enough times to terrify them. Big difference then now. The one thing that made me think that they weakened a bit is that what happened in Georgia last week. I went to a Tea Party rally where a bunch of people were pitching their campaign for the school board. And in 2010, it was Tea Party victory for the school board that. Somebody recognized me. Tea Party victory for the school board and for county executives and for things like that that really emphasize how much they took over. And they didn't win yesterday. So you need to spend a lot of time parsing this.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do quite as well, but still, like, the Republicans who end up running those school boards are going to demand that they're against Common Core. Yeah. Chamber of Commerce, again, they're basically for Common Core education. David Perdue, who is the wealthy businessman who's never run for anything before, has attacked the idea that he never might support Common Core. Jack Kingston's against Common Core. So you see what I'm getting at. Even if the Tea Party doesn't win, they mandate what the party stands for.
That's right. I mean, they win insofar as, I mean, presumably it was not just to get candidates who had some type of branding as Tea Party. It was presumably to push certain policies. I mean, I sort of look at the...
I mean, what changes that Tea Party as a label was more popular in 2009-10, partly because the Republican label was so bad.
Right.
And the Republican Party has kind of recovered a little bit, and the Tea Party label has collapsed. So, I mean, you can see this happening with Democrats. One reason they're talking more about the Koch specifically and less about the Tea Party generally is because they have decided branding large businessmen who are behind all this is better than branding Republicans as the pawns of crazy people. Because, frankly, that backfired a little bit. I mean, remember in 2009 and 10 when these Tea Party activists claimed that if you made fun of what they stood for, you made fun of Glenn Beck, you were attacking regular Americans who worked hard.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I mean, and you know, I think the real agenda here on both sides in many respects, and particularly I think on the Democratic side, is that they want to in some way nationalize this election as much as they can. But it's very hard to do when there's a Democrat in office who's the president, right? I mean, because for the Republicans, it is, and in some respects, they've done this with issues, but the issues are Benghazi, the Import-Export Bank, the Common Core,
I mean, go in any Republican meeting anywhere in the country, and you'll hear people yelling about Common Core, and I think like liberals still have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Yesterday we had we played a clip of someone suggesting, I guess it was in Florida, a Florida state lawmaker saying that the problem with Common Core was that the company that is getting the money for doing all the testing is promoting homosexuality. I mean, so it's sort of like a twofer, I guess, for them in some respect. But I think people are really underestimating how much that Common Core. In fact, in New York, Rob Astorino, I think, had his kids, who's running against Cuomo, had his kids opt out of Common Core and opt out of the testing. I think that's greatly underestimated. It's one of those sort of Tea Party-esque, under the radar issues. And I say Tea Party-esque because the issue with the Common Core is not the same issue that people on the left have with it. It's not so much the implementation, but the idea of just something coming from the federal government. All right, well, let's move on to Kentucky. Now, I know that you never really thought that Matt Bevin had much of a chance. Did that election come out more or less in the way that you thought it would? And how much did Bevin hurt McConnell in the general going forward?
None of this was, it didn't just turn out like I thought it would. It turned out like the polls initially said in July when Bevin got in the race. I think the first poll that came out gave gave McConnell 59% of the vote in a matchup, and Bevin was way back. So Bevin ended up clawing out much of the undecided vote, and McConnell won 60%. So no one changed their minds and turned against McConnell over this long, stupid campaign, a stupid and expensive campaign. I think it didn't end up weakening McConnell that much. In fact, I just kind of flash back to this moment in February when there was a kind of a free vote on the debt limit, and then Ted Cruz demanded it be a roll call, not unanimous consent. I'm sure everyone's like turning their radios up as they get into the jargon. But he demanded that they vote for it. Cornyn and McConnell vote for it, and there was some kind of baseless theorizing, oh, this could hurt with their Tea Party challengers. Well, no, they won. I mean, McConnell didn't shift to the right more than he already had in the previous 4 years to win this thing. I mean, how long has it been since McConnell was for campaign finance disclosure, right? That was his last kind of big thing to the left. His ability to bring pork to the state and stuff, that was limited already. After Republicans won in 2010, they already got rid of earmarks. So he can't do as much of that as he could. He did succeed in getting a couple of things, a couple of grandfather projects in a couple of bills, but he had already been forced to write. He didn't have to change for this primary. And I noticed the strategy against Bevin was to ignore him, which made some sense. The strategy against Allison Lundgren Grimes, if you saw today, is to challenge her to two Lincoln's Douglas-style debates, hinting that she's just dumb and a lightweight, and he can take her apart. And that's because he didn't get on the record anything he's uncomfortable with during the campaign. Some of these guys do. You know, some of these guys panic and go way out on a limb and change their positions. But he already was the right-wing obstruction master of the Congress. The idea that he was liberal and had to switch on something was just this crazy lie by right-wing groups that wanted to raise lots of money.
Now, so Allison Grimes is, of course, going to be his Democratic challenger. What do you make of the turnout? The turnout for the Democrats in the Democratic primary was, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was, I think, relatively significantly higher than it was for the Republicans. Does that mean anything, or is that just, what is that a function of? Because it definitely runs counter to the narrative that Republicans are far more energized, or they just get more energized when they're voting against a Democrat.
There's a boring reason for that, just that Kentucky, like West Virginia and like a lot of the border and southern states, has always been incredibly Democratic. So I think it's still around 53% of the state's voters are registered as Democrats, even though Mitt Romney won the state with, I think, a 25-point landslide. So you've got a popular Democratic governor, Steve Beshear. You have Democrats still running and then competing this year for the House. And there are a lot of those guys, you know, they're just, you don't have this in Georgia anymore. You don't really have it in Arkansas. Some of these places have already turned over, but you do have a ton of guys who just vote Democratic down the ballot for everything and then vote for whatever Republican runs for president. And so that's why you had more of those people turn out. I mean, there are going to be tons of people who show up to the polls and are Democrats and vote for McConnell because they always vote for McConnell, but then they always go back home and vote for, you know, state Brett Jim Beam. I assume that's somebody's name in Kentucky. who's the friendly Democrat who also is super right wing but happens to be a Democrat.
So not much to be gleaned from that. So give me your sense.
Not a ton. Yeah, Democrats aren't thrilled by that. Although, you know, Grimes did better. Some Republicans were desperately trying to spin why only getting 50% in a primary against a goofball was great for McConnell. And they're saying, oh, Grimes only got 70-some% against some fringe candidates. She actually did better than Obama did when he was in the primary. I mean, she's consolidated the Democratic vote better than McConnell people ever thought that she would. They can't pretend otherwise.
And so what do you think that looks like come November? I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a very tight race in some respects. Is Grimes going to actually have those debates?
They haven't said so yet. The impression that she's just so... The thing is, the impression that she's dumb is not true. The impression that she's less comfortable describing what she believes is definitely true. And it's true of a lot of Democrats running in red territory now. It's frankly true. I mean, I don't think people, Scott Brown's campaign, be comfortable letting him debate for an hour. He'd run out of things. He'd start hearing a whistle noise. because he's running in blue territory. People basically disagree with him and vote for against his party. But they'll figure it out. I mean, again, McConnell's campaign focused this tons of attention trying to get Ashley Judd out of the race and embarrass her, and they expected Grimes to not run. So this remains competitive. It's hard to imagine, for the same reason it's tough to imagine Republicans scoring this miracle upset in Oregon that they keep talking about.
Right.
It's hard to imagine McConnell losing, even though he's pretty unpopular. I think he's around 41% popularity in the state. You can win. There have been Democrats with that kind of approval in Massachusetts who survive, and Republicans with that kind of approval in Georgia. And Kentucky is a strange state, too, where, for all the reasons I was saying before, you can appeal to people who have no interest in your party for any other reason because you promise them things. So the guy's been around since the 80s. He's going to pull in voters that shouldn't vote for him in another circumstance.
All right, and you know, I guess I didn't ask that question of Georgia. Give me your sense of Georgia. I mean, do you think that, at least in terms of Kingston versus Perdue, I would imagine that Michelle Nunn would still rather run against a guy like Kingston, probably. Do you think Kingston is going to solidify the Gingrey handle vote or what?
Well, Kingston already got the support of Eric Erickson, which kind of matters in Georgia. I mean, the guys, if you're down there, it's kind of shocking to hear Herman Cain, Eric Erickson on the radio, but they both have radio shows down there. So you have a conflict between the Herman Cain candidate, David Perdue, and the Eric Erickson candidate, Jack Kingston. The argument against that Perdue is basically, as a businessman, he's going to be the kind of guy who wants to be in the room making a deal, which means he's not conservative enough. But neither is terribly exciting. I mean, I think you're going to see Tea Party groups stay out of that. You're not going to see the Club for Growth or anyone really care. I don't think they will try. The problem for both of them is they will have to run to the right to win it, but not as much as they would have if it was a Paul Brown or somebody with a chance. And yeah, Georgia's a state where they're used to having a runoff, so there's going to be some drop off, but not a ton.
Okay, and then we still don't know. We have no sense as to Nunn's chances, but it's obviously a bit of an uphill climb. Let's move to Oregon. Monica Webby, am I pronouncing her name? She prevailed, even though I guess it was some type of weird scandal in the closing days about her stalking people or something.
Well, the closing days is a relative term in Oregon because the state moved years ago to all mail balloting. So most people there have voted a week before the election. And what Democrats were doing was, she's never run for anything. Republicans are high on her basically because she's pretty telegenic and she's not very conservative. And they just want to, let's roll the dice and see what happens. She's also, all she ever talks about is Obamacare. And they think that's good there. She had a relationship that didn't go well. What we knew beforehand was that the one guy in this relationship was funding a super PAC benefiting her. And then what we found out in the last days for the election was that he had previously filed a complaint against her for stalking him, and more details of that came out. So Democrats kind of discredited her in the press when it was too late for Republicans to bail on her. And she ended up winning the primary, but about what her polling showed. But again, we were talking about turnout. That was, Jeff Merkley had no challenge, and it was like twice as many people voted for Jeff Merkley than for her. It's just, he's not, there are Democrats who are caught sleeping or didn't do much in 6 years. I mean, I think the problem with Kay Hagan is that she's run away from what she believes for 6 years, if she believes in things, in North Carolina. Whereas Merkley is such a proud and active progressive who's in sync with the state. But if you really think all they need to do is discredit Webby, and then voters will say, I'll stick with what I know. Sometimes that works. I mean, Todd Akin had one thing discredit him, never recovered. The difference being their party bailed on him too, and the Republicans are still kind of trying to claim that if you criticize Webby's personal crazy life, you hate women. So we'll see how far they get with that.
So let's talk about North Carolina. There wasn't a primary there last night, but what's happening in North Carolina? You've got Tom Tillis won the primary. I guess that was about 3 weeks ago, and he is the speaker of the House in North Carolina. Kay Hagan, like you say, incumbent Democrat senator. Tom Tillis was another one of those guys who was supposedly not a Tea Partier, part of the establishment, but if you look at his voting record, at least I guess from sitting in New York, maybe not so much in North Carolina, but I would imagine so. It seems to me that he is at the sort of the eye of the storm when it comes to these sort of Moral Monday protests. I wonder, is your sense that the energy that seems to be coming out of North Carolina, is that going to be enough to save Kay Hagan?
It helps her a lot, actually. I mean, Tillis had really bad opponents. The idea that he was in danger of losing the thing never made sense to me. I mean, the Rand Paul candidate with this cuckoo, always quote the Constitution, got it wrong half the time. He was the guy who came in second. A lot of the energy in North Carolina, also Georgia, is backlash, movement, grassroots energy created by what the legislature's done. So Tillis is the embodiment of that. Democrats were always comfortable running against him. You know, they prefer him as a horrible candidate, too. He's basically like a pretty unexciting candidate who was at the center of everything that has motivated voter groups that didn't turn out before. So when I was there, I guess a month ago now, that's what Democrats were insisting to me. I mean, what they pointed to is, they won the mayor's race in Charlotte. They won the governor's race in Virginia. Neither of those sound that exciting. But they turned the electorate from the usual midterm lily white country club electorate to a pretty diverse electorate, more like 2012. And part of that, it's politics. No reason being haughty about it. Part of that was making people terrified of the opposition. So if you've got the guy who was responsible for the voter ID bill, and you know that countless black voters in North Carolina were angry about that, and thousands of them rallied and got arrested at the Capitol because of that. Well, that's the guy you want to run against. And it's almost like if Sebelius is running for something in Kansas.
Right.
She has her strengths, but anyone who's angry about Obamacare, that's the bullseye you want to hit.
I mean, that seems to be the two sleeper stories, I think, and there's something akin to Moral Mondays in Georgia as well, is that there's a big debate that has sort of been ongoing about the nature of the electorate in the off-year elections, and that some simply say it's structural. There's nothing that can really impact that, short of a major galvanizing national issue. But some suggest that it's really just a question of of motivating those voters who would show up in 2012 or showed up in 2008 and who are anticipated to show up in 2016. Seems to me if that theory is accurate, then in North Carolina and in Georgia, we may see something that is surprising because of just how, just motivated people are who would normally not be motivated to vote in an off-year election.
Yeah, I mean, that was a factor that didn't exist in 2010 because it was a total theory. The idea that Republicans would take over and ruin things for you, that you had no idea. And in North Carolina, Republicans hadn't run the state in your lifetime, period. And so in 2010, they didn't show up. In 2010, they did, they meaning African-Americans. And, you know, North Carolina got closer than Republicans wanted it to be, and Georgia was an 8-point race, and they thought it was going to be like a 15-point race. If those people turn, and in Georgia's case at least, they held some seats that they weren't supposed to hold in the legislature. So that happens again. I mean, then they stay competitive in those places. Now, them staying competitive in North Carolina means like they don't lose a seat they should have already. But that is, and that's one of the keys. I mean, a lot of the, kind of like writing about the election gets frustrating sometimes because you kind of can turn everything back to who votes in the midterms and who doesn't. And there are these, you know, soul-killing analyses. There are like 5,000 new data journalism sites that just write that article every day. But no, there are a lot of Democrats trying to reach out personally to voters, not just, you know, not just say, hey, this is bad and mention on TV, but go door to door and point this stuff out to people who don't normally vote and change them into midterm voters. And if they do, that completely changes the math in that's Georgia, which is a toss-up state. North Carolina, which is a Democratic state, Arkansas, which is a state that Republicans thought they would easily win. They don't win there. They don't win the Senate.
Yeah. So what's happening in Arkansas? There were, I guess, Tom Cotton won the Republican primary unopposed, and Pryor wins the Democratic primary unopposed. I guess that those outcomes were not necessarily in doubt. But what's happening on the ground there? I mean, do you have a sense of how that race is shaping up?
I haven't actually been to that state yet because it was always going to be a big stretch in the general election. So Cotton has one of the best resumes of any candidate, and that's what everyone leads with. And he's this 30-something Harvard law grad and Iraq and Afghanistan veteran. He's also incredibly boring. And he just kind of struggled to explain where he stands on things apart from being against the Democrats, which is, you know, a problem some places. This is the thing. Sometimes you'll get a candidate Republicans are happy with, like that Monica Webby in Oregon, who seems pretty adroit discussing things. And then you'll have somebody that they thought was a slam, and oh, we're surprised. Somebody who thought this slam dunk like Cotton, who just doesn't seem to have figured out how to do this yet. The thing that makes Republicans optimistic is that, you know, Pryor has always been in the 40s of popularity. And for all the hate they pour on the Club for Growth, I think starting February 2013, like a month after Obama's inauguration, they were spending money on ads against Pryor.
Wow.
You will eventually have by far the most expensive Senate race in history, most of it money spent against Mark Pryor. And they think, well, okay, on the margin, we're going to take that one. But They went in with a lot of expectation and braggadocio that's being challenged.
All right. So lastly, let's talk about Pennsylvania. There was I don't believe there was any type of – it's not really obviously in play in terms of the Senate, but Tom Wolf beat out Allison Schwartz for the nomination for governor. I mean, it seems to me that Corbett is in big trouble, right? I mean, but is that a fairly accurate perspective on that?
Yeah, he's pretty screwed. I mean, he's been a kind of weak, stumbling governor in no one respects. And the poll, so the hope they had was that some weak liberal Democrat come out of the primary. Instead, Wolf, who's a self-funder, who's pretty respected, not only won the primary, but he was polling, I think, around 25 points ahead of people, and he ended up winning by 35. And the first polls against Corbett, he's up by about 22, 25 points. It's one of those races, unless Corbett shows some life, no one's going to come in and help him. I mean, the Republican Governors Association, they already have, they're sweating races in Maine, in Florida, in Kansas, I think they're going to spend more money trying to take Illinois than to win Pennsylvania. So I think the two people most likely to take over a state from the other party are Bruce Rauner, who's a Republican in Illinois, and Corbett, who's the Democrat in Pennsylvania, which will have consequences. I mean, if you have a Democratic governor in Pennsylvania again, that's no more voter ID laws are going to pass before the 2016 election. You're not going to have the Republican Party bragging about how they locked up the state for Ted Cruz or whatever. If there's one like a clear piece of good news for Democrats last night, it's probably that.
And for Democrats, maybe not so much progressives who would, there's been a lot of, it seems to me, sort of very corporatist Dems that have been the governor of Pennsylvania. But
the dream is that you, Corbett was so bad you could elect a progressive like Allison Schwartz. She was progressive on social issues, but she was tied into healthcare industry. She opposed IPAB. No one was an ideal progressive choice in that race. I think Al Gore got behind an environmentalist, former, I want to say EPA or Energy Department official, and she got like 7%. The rich guy crushed everybody, as sometimes happens in both parties.
All right. So what am I leaving out? What is you got a sleeper race for us or something that you think is not getting the attention that it should heading into November? I should also say that one of those data-driven sites, The Upshot, said that the Democrats now have a 59% chance of retaining a majority. I think they said that last night.
It's largely based on prior Daniels that are, and I think Brown falling apart in New Hampshire and a couple of things in the margins. The sleeper would be Idaho, which no one cared about because polls didn't close till 11. But I'd recommend people read this article in Business Week by John McCormick and someone else about how it wasn't just the Chamber of Commerce that backed Mike Simpson, who was the incumbent congressman that conservatives are trying to beat. There was local businesses were lobbying their own employees to go out and vote for the guy, and they were doing what Republicans always panic about when unions do it, but they were doing it for this conservative but not quite Tea Party member of Congress. And, he crushed him. I mean, that was the Club for Growth big race for the year that was supposed to be fairly easy. And I think they lost by 25 points.
And so what does that tell us?
I think it tells us it's kind of funny that it took 4 years for smart, rich businessmen to realize if you spend money, you can win elections. But, no, that's one of the themes. They figure that out, and they're going to spend a lot of money. The question is, do they evolve to the point where, let's say right now, Tea Party need to spend anything to, scare an incumbent, make her win by 5 points, and make it so she won't vote for immigration reform. Does the chamber, after these primaries are over, get so confident that it lobbies Republicans to pass an immigration bill in the fall? That would change a lot of things. That would change the way Republicans look to some voters. That would alienate some of their base. And you do have Republican leaders who want that. So the thing I'm kind of looking for down the line is whether the chamber feels its oath and demands a policy shift from Republicans, or if it can't. I mean, it took conservatives years and years and years to make it toxic to oppose what they want. So these guys are trying to kickstart with a lot of money in a hurry.
Yeah, and we should just say on that note, people forget, but this anti-immigration bill, I'm being generous here, by sentiment by the Republican base predates the branding of the Tea Party, right? I mean, this was Rove and Bush's sort of greatest lament, that they could not get the party there. I mean, that seems to be that seems to be the sort of the bellwether that is indicative of the Tea Party being, a brand as much as anything else. The notion that, the anti-immigration bill sentiment certainly predates the moniker Tea Party. And I guess maybe on some level, it will be interesting to see if if the big money thinks that they can get some type of immigration reform. I doubt it. But
I mean, now that they've done it, it just seems like it was so easy to knock these clowns aside once they tried. So we'll see. I haven't decided yet. I just think that's where they realize that everyone they endorsed and backed is not pro-immigration reform, but the next step, obviously, would be for them to make it impossible not to be that way. I don't think they're there yet, but we'll see.
All right. Dave Weigel, thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. All right, folks. So there it is. I would say that is probably the first time in literally years we have done sort of like a horse race type of analysis. You probably won't hear another one. You know, occasionally Cliff and I will talk about this on Fridays because he's also pretty knowledgeable about these things. But Weigel is one of the best reporters of this stuff. And it's the real takeaway here, and I think that, you know, the nuance of just how much the sort of the old line money in the Republican circles is willing to sort of back people who don't necessarily support their top two or three agenda items, or I should say one, really, it's immigration reform, is I think it's indicative of just how much the Tea Party, and it's not, you know, I've been saying for years, there is no Tea Party as distinct from the Republican base. This is just simply the Republican base, and a couple of billionaires decided we're going to fund these people in the same way that the Club for Growth did before. And we're just going to take a slightly different tact. We're going to pour some money in there, create these groups, and use them to the best of our ability. And to a certain extent, they have... If the Tea Party is waning, it's simply because it's a victim of its own success. You know, name for me, like I said, Jack Kingston apparently has a 94% rating, 93% rating on a Tea Party scorecard. So what do you point at?
Oh, I was just saying that. I mean, the other big thing that Jack Kingston was known for in the past couple of months, the extent he made any national news, because he is a relatively dull guy, was backing a Newt Gingrich-style poor kids should work for their school lunch program.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it's just feeding what you're saying. I mean, this is not somebody who is anything other than radically right-wing, but yes, is a bit more dull and a little bit more
media
pleasant.
Trained. Media trained. They just, you know, and maybe, you know, I would imagine actually specifically media trained, but just media savvy, just realizing they're just better quality politicians, but their positions, their substantive positions have not changed. And that is the point.
Well, and also like what the other thing is just interesting that a lot of these guys came, I think, you know, under the quote, Gingrich revolution, and those were the first wave of they weren't Tea Party, but they were the radical
no compromise.
Far right, right, no compromise contract with America. So I mean, that's them. That's Joe Scarborough, for God's sake, and he's always running around MSNBC talking about how Republicans should be you know, moderated.
Well,
I don't even know what that
a,
even
he
means
has a different constituency.
I understand that's his personal brand, but I'm saying it's like these guys, even where they came from, was just literally the precursor.
Right, and they haven't moved off it. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. We are loaded up, folks. What is it with game show hosts?
Who are the other game show hosts that are crazy?
Chuck Woolery.
I don't even know who that is.
All right. And sorry. I get it. Grandpa, go to sleep. I get it. We'll hear from... A Florida lawmaker who has a very interesting idea on how he can deal with uninformed voters. We'll talk
not
about
media trained.
Yes, not media trained. NSA reform legislation loses support from privacy and civil libertarian groups because it was sort of went through I'll talk about it. It went through a very extensive process and then was watered down at the last minute. Chipotle throws its hat into the ring with the One Worlders trying to infringe upon your rights, ladies and gentlemen. And this is just lovely. The House GOP agriculture bill decides to get rid of a relatively small program that's intended to provide meals to children through the school lunch program, but during the summer months. Because apparently, if you can't afford to eat during the school year, you also can't afford to eat during the summer lunches. Republicans quashed that part of the program. No surprise there. But then they reinstituted it. But for a particular group of people. We will talk about who those people are and are not. And after the administration last night agreed to release a memo written by David Barron, who was a DOJ lawyer who authored secret documents justifying the use of drones to kill Americans overseas. It looks like his nomination will pass through the Senate Judiciary Committee. We will see. And we'll also talk about Rick Santorum. Have we even heard from him since Pennsylvania became so cats and dogs? Maybe that's what it is. He's got to stay inside because of the cats and dogs that are reigning there. All right, folks. Reminder, your membership is what keeps this show alive. You can become a member today at majority.fm. You want to call the show, be a part of the program? We have a special line for libertarians today. It's 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Or for the rest of people, thinking people, you can call 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's great coffee. And for the price of three coffees at your local coffee place, you can get, I don't even know how many coffees you get out of a bag of, a pound bag of coffee. But, and you can support this program. It's great coffee. It's fair trade. It's employee owned. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. JustCoffee.coop. And if you buy junk from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Go to MajorityReportKickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your stuff from Amazon through that link. You will notice no difference. It's a one-time deal that you have to do that. And then every time you buy something on Amazon, no difference to you, we get a little kickback. All right, 646-257-3920, or you can IM me. IM me at Majority FM through AIM, or... Wait, I thought we were going to do a different... What do you mean? Oh.
I forgot to grab them.
Unbelievable.
Tomorrow, you will get some new La Poupée.
Yeah, I pulled a bunch of new ones.
Enjoy this La Poupée while it lasts. Because today will be the last day for a long while you hear this version.
Probably not so long.
Enjoy it. 646-257-3920.
You can IM me at Majority FM on AIM or via the app, which you can get at majorityapp.com. We'll be back in a minute.